So, folks, we have a fascinating topic today. The topic is vacationing in Egypt. Everybody needs to decide if they want to stay for this year or not before we start it. So the question arises, and it has been arising most recently a number of times in the last year, the last few months. So two times, actually, in the last year, I've had the opportunity of being asked in the last few months about vacationing in Egypt. So just to take things back a little bit to appreciate where we are. I remember I saw a advertisement from over a century ago, from the 19-teens, early teens, and it was a picture of a vacation destination in the Catskills. And the advertisement was about the beautiful hotels and campuses, and that it was Jew free in the Catskills. That was the advertisement. And then when I was looking at that, it was a Jew free vacation. And I realized that that's precisely why all the Jews ended up in the Catskills, because the Jews just so badly want to fit into whatever society they're in, that wherever they're not let in, or wherever they don't have access to, they'll make a way. And they do that the same thing about all the clubs that they weren't let into, and they do that with all the universities they weren't let into, and all the all the law firms they weren't let into. The Jews create equivalents, and they succeed, despite the fact that there have been so much overt anti-Semitism in every country that they've been in, including America. It's an amazing thing. But that should also explain that, therefore, where we vacate, where we decide to spend time having a vacation, also is a reflection of trying to be like the folks around us, right? So let's be honest about things. And therefore, the reason why it is not enough just to go to the same old places like the Catskills anymore, and we have to be going to the most radical of places around the world, is as a function of the society around us, which is restless and has money to spend and time to spend and wants to see fascinating things. So in fact, recently, I just heard about somebody, one of our security guards, who just took a trip during December to visit Antarctica. I am waiting to hear about the first kosher tour to Antarctica. It wouldn't surprise me. And I am almost positive that as soon as we start private space travel, there will be a kosher program going up as well. So, meaning to say, all it is a matter of time, but we have to be honest that the reason why it's so exciting is because the society around us is doing it. So we're doing the same thing. We just want to be part of it. Included in that right now is the new fad at this point in time is going back to Egypt. Right, so why is that back? It's because we left Egypt. That's what we talk about every Pesach. I'm just waiting for the first Pesach program in Egypt.
It was called Pesach with the Pyramids.
There we go. So very, very apropos. Certainly, clearly missed the theme of the day, but nonetheless, I'm sure the food was great. So now the question is what happens? How do we look at this when it comes to Egypt? And it's so fascinating because people have a sensitivity to ask this question because we know there's something not 100% right. What is not 100% right, and how does that fit into the way we do things? So the truth is, the Torah tells you you're not allowed to do it. So the Torah says about Egypt, it says a number of places. A few of them are actually, so to speak, prophecies. The other one seems to be actually a specific mitzvah. The prophecies might not be called prescriptive. They may be descriptive. So like as an example, in and amidst Parshas Beshalach, as Israel is literally leaving Egypt, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says to Bnei Israel in the first source, Vayomer Moshe el ha'am, al tirou, this is by the edge of the Red Sea, see the salvation of God, which is about to be done today. You will never see Egypt again. Now, if this is all we had, we could say maybe it means Egypt as the nation, or might be a description. It might be a prediction. It might be a positive future, right? But it may not be a prescription.
As you see it today, you will not see it again.
Good. So there's much equivocating we can make if this were to be the only thing we have. However, then we move later on to Parshas Kisavo. And the topic of Parshas Kisavo, primarily, the main section of Kisavo is the curses. The curses are what happens if the nation of Israel don't listen to what's supposed to be there. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu says is one of the terrible things is that's going to be in Source 3. Source 2 is in the Torah. V'ashivcha Hashem Mitzrayim bo'aniyos b'derech asher amarti l'cha lo'soysif oed li'roysa. I'm going to sell you down the stream, literally, to Egypt. I'm going to sell you as slaves back into Egypt in the place that I told you you'd never have to go back to. So the Torah, by the way, is quoting what?
Itself.
Good. So the Torah is quoting Moshe's prophecy to the Israelites, saying, I told you you'd never have to go back and see it, but if you don't behave yourselves, I'm going to sell you back into the worst place, the place you should never have gone back to. That's how bad it's going to be. It's sort of that scene is the worst. That's like a progression of evil is how far back it goes. And finally, now when we come to specifically that in Parashas Shoftim, where we talk about a king, one of the regulations, the checks and power imbalance of a king is Rak lo yarbe lo susim. The king is not allowed to increase or to have a sizable amount of horses. V'la'ashiv esa'om mitzrayma. In order not to bring the people back to Egypt, leman arbo sus. V'asher omar lochem lo susifun lo shuv baderech hazeh. Or because God already told you not to go back. So who's the Torah quoting? Itself. Again, not, and it seems to be that it's quoting itself as a prescription, not a description. It's saying, when I told you in Parashas B'Shalach, that means I told you you won't, you should not. And therefore, the king should be careful. What do horses have to do with Egypt? The greatest horses come from Egypt. Even today, we call the prize horses are Egyptian stallions, right? I remember I was actually once in Wisconsin on vacation, and we went to watch a horse show, and their star horse was the Egyptian stallion, which they managed to get.
Pharaoh, the guy from
Teenage. Yeah, it's okay. Fantastic. Yeah, let's all go to Belmont together. Okay, so that's the closest we can do. So nonetheless, there seems to be horse trade certainly then, and even today. The greatest of horses come from Egypt, so don't get involved in that trade. That's not a Jewish trade, because it's going to end up being, once you start having trade, and you start having representatives, and you start having a company, and you have a few employees, and you have, so don't do that. So that's what's being told over here. So the Torah tells us in these times, now, it seems to take this very seriously. The Torah seems to tell us pretty unequivocally about this. The question is okay, so how did this play itself out in history? Because it seems that if you read a little bit back and you Google Jews in Egypt, there were many Jews in Egypt over the course of history, right? So up till pretty recently, up till the 50s essentially, maybe early 60s. So there are a number of times that Jews went to Egypt, and Tanakh even records a few. So like as an example, the Mechilta, which is the Midrash Halacha. Oh, so just to take a little step backwards. So what did I do? When I reached this question, it's a fascinating question when people ask about this. So this particular question, I actually submitted to Rav Yosef Carmel. Rav Yosef Carmel is the Av Beis Din of Eretz Chemda in Israel, which is a very, very well-recognized institution which trains Dayanim in Israel. Very, very impressive institution. Rav Carmel actually visited our shul last year in May time, and he was talking about Shemitah and the Otzar Beis Din program with Dr. Bergman that they worked on together. And so he trains a number of Dayanim, and he has an institute which also answers complex questions. So if you have a question which has a lot of meat to it, like this question, It's fascinating to go through. So one of the Dayanim, of course, is Rabbi Danny Mann. So Alan, you mentioned he may give a shiur on this. I think it might be because of this question. Yeah. So I'm very happy to have facilitated this discussion. But I'd like to go through some of the sources that were put together on this topic, because it is a very important topic to be considering, to be aware of. So let's start at the beginning. So did Jews ever go out to Egypt despite this? The answer is yes. In fact, Mechilta identifies three times that Jews in the times of in times of antiquity, were going to Egypt. So the first is, the Midrash is in source 4, but we're going to skip the first section where it talks about the mitzvahs. Really, we're looking at the third line where it says, B'shloshtam chazru sham, B'shloshtam naflu. There were three times Jews went back to Egypt, and three times they fell as a function of that. Harishana, the first one, Abimei Sancheriv. The first is in times of Sancheriv, the Syrian emperor. Shenemar ha'am havu yo'hoi ha'yordim Mitzrayim le'ezra. So remember, Israel was caught in this unpleasant middle ground between two very powerful nations, the Egyptians in the south and the Assyrians in the north. And what happened was is that Israel was essentially the connector in the Fertile Crescent between those two. And Israel were very much a buffer to the Assyrians, so much so that the northern kingdom of Israel was exiled in multiple military tours by the Assyrians to other countries, those we call the 10 lost tribes. And while that was unfolding, and while that was predicted, Yeshayahu, who was the prophet at the time, speaking to those folks, and he says, woe to those who escaped the Assyrians to go to Egypt. He says, it's not going to work out. And Haraya, and the proof is that we don't know about any of those Jews anymore, right? Those Jews never really amounted to much. That was the end. They sort of went off into exile, and they never really returned. We don't know anything about those Jews. That's the first round. Number two is, and this one is the more famous one, is if you read the end of Sefer Yirmiyahu, this is a terrible situation that occurs, and that is after the murder of Gedaliah ben Achikam. If you remember what happens is there's two factions, well, there's multiple, but two ideological factions in Israel. Faction number one is really educated by Yirmiyahu. Jeremiah says that it's not worth fighting the Babylonians. Pay Babylonian taxes. They're the empire that is. And we don't have the merit to fight them. So pay the taxes. Now, Yirmiyahu was seen as a traitor. He was seen as a, so to speak, an insider for the Babylonians, which is why the Israelites treated him so harshly. They put him in prison. They threatened him. They tried to kill him multiple times because they looked at him as a political traitor. But he wasn't a political traitor. He was a spokesman for God's values, which was that now's not the time to fight. So when the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, after one of the many, many sieges of Jerusalem that the Babylonians put on Jerusalem, and when they finally said, these folks are just not listening, no matter how many times we punish them, they're not listening, they burnt down the Beis HaMikdash, and Yirmiyahu, of course, was given a green card, right? Because Yirmiyahu was seen by the Babylonians as one of theirs, so to speak, because as an ally, an ideological ally. Which wasn't the case. He wasn't being paid by Babylon, but he was giving a message which aligned with their political interest. And so therefore, when the Babylonians chose a governor of the area land of Israel, post their destruction, they chose somebody who was a student of Yirmiyahu, whose name was Gedaliah ben Achikam. Right in Gedaliah, where Gedaliah's foreign policy was very much in line with peace with Babylon. However, there were still folks who felt otherwise. And there was a group saying, no, we should show them, and we're going to push them back, and we're going to take over, and we're going to push them out, and right in that group. And so there was this fellow, Yishmael, who for his own, whether it be his own personal interest or political interest, took advantage of the situation and killed Gedaliah on Rosh Hashanah, when Gedaliah welcomed him into his palace, despite the warnings about him, and then was murdered, and then he went and massacred other Jews who were coming from the northern areas who just heard about the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. Terrible situation. We have a fast day because of that, when Jews are killing Jews. And so what happens is, we should be fasting on Rosh Hashanah. The reason why we do it afterwards is because that's the first time we can fast. But it really happened actually on Rosh Hashanah. Can you believe it? But what happened afterwards was that once that had happened, When Yishmael came into the palace, he didn't just kill Gedaliah and his court. He killed the Babylonian god as well, right? Because that was his ideology, right? Is throw out the Babylonians. So there now that's not good news. That's like sort of lighting the fuse, right? So how long does it take to reach the explosives, right? So that's the question. So then the Jews now started fighting with each other, because they knew the Babylonians were going to send a reprisal. So what did they do? So there were two factions. There was this fellow called Yochanan ben Kareach, and he went over and attacked Yishmael, right, for doing this. But now the question is, so what do we do? Do we fight? Do we stay? And so there was a whole delegation that said, we're going to go back to Egypt. That's where we can be safe, because at least Egypt is at least militarily safe from the Babylonians at this point in time. And Yirmiyahu says, don't go. And they didn't listen. They went. So that was the second time. And guess what? We don't know about them. They didn't come back from exile, that entire group, post the Gedaliah massacre. So this is a terrible time. That's the second time. This is the Mechilta. And finally, the Mechilta says, the third one is the names of Turninus. And I believe that's going to be one of the situations that we're going to talk about now, which is the Alexandrian Jewish community, which is the next stage after the second Beis HaMikdash destruction. So the Midrash is basically saying it's a woebegone place, right? It's not a place that we should be frequenting. And if you look historically, all the folks who ran, generally speaking, from an exile, whether it's Assyrian, Babylonian, or Roman, It wasn't good. It didn't work out well. That's what the Midrash is essentially saying. So let's just dig a little bit further into that. Very famously, we know about the Alexandrian Jewish community. This community was so famous and has lots of implications for Corona, which is why it was very helpful in many ways. So catch the implication as we learn it. So this Gemara in Sukkos very famously tells us about this incredible place in Alexandria. Alexandria is one of the cities in Egypt. It says, Tanya Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Mishel Loi Ra'a Deyuf Lu Stun, Shel Alexandria Shel Mitzrayim. So that word is referring to a synagogue, as it's translated over here. It should be noted that the word Dio refers to double. Okay, why? Well, what is the double meaning? We'll get that in just a second, but there was this incredible synagogue in Alexandria in Egypt. Lo ra'a b'chod en shal Yisrael, you didn't appreciate the grandeur of Israel. Amru k'min b'silkei g'doy la'hoysa stav lifnim istav. There was sort of these colonnades within colonnades in this shul. Pa'amim shayu ba kiflaim k'yotz Mitzrayim. They had more than two times the amount of Israelites or Hebrews leaving Egypt would be associated or in this shul, or whatever, if that means in actually or in their surrounding area. Vayu ba shivim v'achas katedros shel zahav, these 71 thrones of gold, keneged shivim v'achas shel Sanhedrin gadol, like the council of 71. In fact, there was a council of 71 in Alexandria at the time. Kol achas v'achas eino pesucha pechusa me'esrim v'echad riboy kikrei zahav. I mean, it tells the weight of each of them. Ubima shall eight be MCE saw, and they had this bima in the middle. The Chazana Knesses on Medaleva Sudarin Biyodai. So he would, the Chazana Knesses would be sitting there, and he had a large flag in his hand. They came on Shigia la Nois Amen, Halo Menif, Vesuda, Vakola Amanim Amen, and you'd have to wave the flag. Now, I am assuming it's not because everybody was talking, right? Which is a possibility, but it could be just because the distance was so far. Right, that nobody could actually hear, no matter how great the chazan was, that the room was so large, it was such an incredibly big place, you have to wave in order for people to say amen. This is very helpful for Corona. Why? Because the question that became is, when we went into davening, and we had a daven in our own homes, and all people, let's say we returned to shul and there was a minyan, and we had Zoom as an option for those who are housebound and so on, the question is, what can you answer? What can you answer if you're not in the presence of a minyan? And one of the things you can answer is amen, because you don't have to be present for them, and you need to know when it's actually happening. Right? So the flag waving was helpful in the sense they couldn't actually hear, but they could answer. You can't answer everything, but there are a number of things you can answer, which is based on this an understanding of this Gemara. Just fascinating application.
There was still in one domain. It's a little different.
Yes.
Those were probably the lucky.
True, exactly. So is it Dvar Shabbat Kedusha, or is it simply Amen to another thing? Exactly. But there was a lot of discussions around surrounding this particular Gemara Beer,
isn't it? We use this method in the Bells of Shul today.
Really?
Yes.
That's fantastic. Well, the Bells of Shul is incredibly large, so yeah. there must be some way to do this.
Larger than the Beis HaMikdash itself.
What was that?
None of these were larger than the Beis HaMikdash itself.
Hard to know, yeah. But Lichara not. But I mean,
and when the Kohen Gadol said, you know, and everyone fell down, everyone bowed at the same time, somehow they didn't have trouble hearing.
It's true. It's true. There must have been some sort of relation. There must have been a way to pass it out. But nonetheless, there's it's a good question. Good question. So it's a little bit hazy. We'll see in a second. It's a little bit hazy, but there is, historically speaking, I think we can work it out. Well, hang on. Let's just read the end of Gemara, because the Gemara gives us an assertion which is harder to appreciate. And by the way, this shul was fantastic. They had employment areas in the shul, you know. So all, you know, the entrepreneurs were in that section, and all the, you know, the startups were in that section, and all the doctors were in that section, all the accountants were in that section. So they could make connections, right, of course, after davening, to make sure that everybody would find their jobs. You know, I wonder how the kiddushes work. They have separate kiddushes. But nonetheless, the Gemara tells us this is unbelievable. This is like a thriving Jewish community. And then says Abaye, now a little bit of a downer. Omar Abai at the end, Vakulo, Katlinu, Alexandros Mokton. And all of them were killed by Alexander the Macedonian. My time in Yanush. Why were they punished? Mishum da'avrei ahai kra. Why were they punished? Because they transgressed the pasuk, which is lo sasuv lo shuv b'derech hazeh od. Inu ahadru aso. So they went back to Egypt. You're not supposed to go back to Egypt. That's what the Gemara says. That's a pretty depressing idea. But nonetheless, that's what the Gemara says. Now, so you say, when was this? So the Gemara attributes this to the destruction under Alexander the Macedonian. We also call him Alexander the Great. Truth be told, actually, it seems that it might not be the Alexander that we're talking about. Because if you read Josephus, and he talks about the War of the Jews, he talks about the thriving community in Alexandria. But he talks about it towards the end of the second Beis HaMikdash, and which is a little bit later, right? Alexander the Macedonian was earlier. It was mid to early second Beis HaMikdash. But there is an Alexander, but he was a Roman, Julius Alexander. So it is interesting because actually when Alexander came to conquer the known world, which he did at an extremely fast rate, conquering Asia Minor and North Africa, when he conquered the areas of North Africa, what happened was is the Jews who lived in Alexandria at the time actually aided Alexander the Macedonian. And because they did, he granted them privileges as Greeks. He allowed them to have privileges of being on an equal tier to the Greeks. So the Alexandrian Jewish community specifically, actually, was a great beneficiary of Alexander the Great's policies because of their political alignment. And so if you read Josephus, you start seeing that becomes an issue later on because guess what? The Alexandrians didn't like that so much. Right? Why are these Jews doing so well? Right? Because they were able to succeed under the umbrella privileges of the Grecians. And there was tension which led to riots towards the end. And finally, when the Jews of Israel rebelled against the Romans, similarly the Alexandrian Jews also aligned themselves with the Jews in Israel, and they were crushed by the Romans. Right, and we hear about they sent an army of 5,000, and according to the numbers, there were 50,000 Jews who were murdered in Alexandria, the great shuls being destroyed. And this is what's recorded. So it's fascinating that it could be a little bit of a later stage, but the particular Roman governor at the time was the person by the name of Julius Alexander, so it could refer to that individual as well. And there afterwards, there were many more complications afterwards. It's worthwhile noting, just more recent times, just to get a sense of the numbers, is that in 1937, this is on page 3, the Jews living in Alexandria, there were 24,690 Jews living in Alexandria, and in 1947, 21,000. So that's a significant community in the 1940s. And then according to the 1947 census, 59% of the Alexandrian Jews were merchants, 18% were artisans. And upon the outbreak of the Israeli War independence, several Jews were placed in detention camps, such as that at Abu Kir. Many of the detainees were released before 1950. There were several assaults on the Jewish community by the local population, including throwing of a bomb in the synagogue in July 1951. The Nasser's ascension to power in 1954, where many Jews were arrested on charges of Zionism, communism, and currency smuggling. After the Sinai campaign in 1956, thousands of Jews were banished from the city, while others left voluntarily when Alexandrian Stock Exchange ceased to function. And by 1960, there were only 2,700 left. And after 1950, and in the Six-Day War, 350 Jews were detained in camps. And during 1970, there were only 12 left. And today, there are 16 Jews left living in Egypt, 10 of them in Alexandria, which is more, generally speaking, liberal in terms of Jewish population. And today, the court cases still go on. I mean, it doesn't really make so much of a difference about all the lost assets of the Jews who were forced to leave Egypt, and many very wealthy Jews had to leave with literally their shirts on their back, and can read all the books about them, the man in the white shark suit, and all the many fascinating stories of Egyptian Jewry, which endured for so many centuries and ended very abruptly. It's worthwhile remembering just at this point in time, just as a note, in the 1940s to 1960s, there were 1.5 million refugees in the Middle East, more than half of them being Jews. But you don't hear about the Jewish refugees because they're absorbed into the fledgling state of Israel, whereas the 600,000 to 700,000 Arab refugees are still being talked about today because not one of the 23 Arab states even opened so much as a door to citizenship or a bit to hosting their Arab brethren. So that's something worthwhile remembering in terms of this. And those Jews have become part of the societies of America or Israel predominantly.
There's a Gemara about an encounter between Alexander Maidon and Shimon HaTzadik. That might give it a little place. Shimon HaTzadik was Mashiach HaTzadik. That would be the end of Baal Shein.
Yeah, so that whole conversation, but that was at the time, Alexander the Great had a favorable relationship with the Jews. And that was expressed by Shimon HaTzadik, and you see it over here, and historically Josephus talks about it in terms of the Jews actually siding with him in terms of the war in North Africa.
Is that when the name Alexander entered, where everyone started naming their Jewish children.
Yeah, so Alexander has sort of become part of the population. So there's a favorable relationship. Nichora, the Gemara is referring to the later attacks of the Jews under the Romans and the Grecian Alexandrians who were not in favor of the Jews succeeding so much in their society. That's what it seems to be. But be it as it may, it ended. Right? So that society had its time, and the Jews were very successful as they were in any society that allowed them to even have any jobs. And that was the outcome of this. Let's take it one step further. So you say to yourself, okay, but there were many very, very great sages who lived in Egypt. can you think of a name? Rav Moshe ben Maimon. Maimonides was one of the greatest Jews of all time, lived in Egypt, in Fustat. Another Jew who lived just after the Rambam, who commented on the Rambam, was a man by the name of Rav David ben Zimra, known by his acronym as the Radvaz. The Radvaz was the chief rabbi in Cairo for over 40 years. He wrote over 3,000 responsa, just to understand that. He was unbelievably prolific. Tremendous, tremendous individuals able to analyze subjects from any matter in Judaism. You can read the response of the Radvaz. Incredible, incredible to read. And yet they lived in Egypt. So how do we square that? They certainly knew about this. In fact, the Rambam even paskens the halach of not leaving Egypt, living in Egypt, in his halachic work called the Mishnah Torah. So how does that work? So that's the question we have to figure out. And maybe that'll help us in terms of today as well. So let's start at the beginning. Just before actually doing that, it is worthwhile noting that the Sefer Kaftor Vaferach, which is a book which is dedicated to the myth of living in the land of Israel, says the most fascinating thing. And he quotes a tradition in Source 8, where he talks about the Rambam and how the Rambam would sign off his letters. And he says, this is I've seen this actually in its first hand, but he says in Source 8, he says, a person who lives in Egypt transgresses three prohibitions. Shamati b'Mitzrayim mipi Rav Shmuel Zal, echad mibnei bonav shel Aram Bamzal. Okay, he quotes one of the grandchildren of the Rambam who says, "Keshe Aram Zal when Rav Moshe, that's the Rambam, hoya chaseim shemoi beigeres shlucha, when he would sign off his name in letters that he would send, hoya mesayem hakosev haover bechol yom shlosha lavim ploni." So he says, whenever you sign off, he says, signed off by he who transgresses three prohibitions every day. Wow, so the Rambam himself looked at this as he was living in a less than ideal circumstance. That seems to be from the Rambam's perspective. So you say, well, he still did it, so how did that work? What's really going on over here? So let's examine some of the mitigating factors. So mitigating factor number one happens to be based on a Gemara which is to be found in Sanhedrin in the Talmud Yerushalmi. Back to Source 6, I put it in the wrong place. The Talmud Yerushalmi says, Lo yisosifu noshu b'derech zeh ha'od liyishiva in ein ata chozer chozer at l'schora l'prakmatia v'lichbosh es ha'aretz. You may not go there to live there, but you may go there in order to trade or there to conquer. Okay, fascinating. The trade thing is worthwhile thinking about because it seems that that's what the Torah was saying about the king, right? That the whole idea of the horses is going to lead to trade, which may lead to settling down. But be it as it may, it's just fascinating. So it seems to be that we're talking about that the way the Gemara understands it over here, the Talmud Yerushalmi, is it's not, you're not allowed to go there in order to settle down. And that's in fact how the Rambam paskins is the halacha. Okay, remember that the Shulchan Aruch does not talk about these halachas because this is not the moralistic picture. The Rambam talks about every aspect in Hilchas Melachim, where he says the following in Source 9. He says very strongly, "Umutar lishkon b'chol olam." You're allowed to live anywhere in the world, including Antarctica, chutz mi eretz Mitzrayim, except for Egypt. Min ayam gadol v'adam arav arba me'os parson. He gives the boundaries of the land, and then at the end of it, he says, at the end of the halacha, he says, "V'Alexandria bichlala iser." And Alexandria is included, right? You know, there's going to be somebody who's going to say, oh, technically speaking, at one point in time, you're not allowed to do that. It's also part of the Nile Basin, in the Nile Delta. If you look back on page 2, I just put in the map there, it's a little bit small. But you can see that most of the cities, in fact, I believe today that the statistic is that 94% of the population of Egypt lived within a couple miles of the Nile. Now, Egypt is massive. But again, it's a water-centric country, and so 94% of the population is within. You can see all the major cities are in the Nile Delta, Alexandria being one of them, and this is considered part of the part of where people are. And so the Rambam says that is included in the Isser as well. So then he goes on to say, Mucha lachzor le'eretz Mitzrayim l'schora l'pragmatia, quotes the Yerushalmi, you're allowed to go back for trade, v'lichbosh artzos acheros, and to conquer other lands. So let's say you're going to conquer Libya, right? So you have to go through Egypt, so you're allowed to do that as well. V'ein osur le'lishtakeh sham, you cannot, the Isser is only to nishtakeh, to put down roots and to settle there. V'ein loikin alav zeh, you don't get malchus technically, because the person who's entering, you don't know what the intention of the person is as they walk in. That's the action, right? And at the time the person says, you know what, I'm just going to pay a mortgage, at that point in time, then the person's already entered. It would seem to me, says the Rambam, Shim kovash eretz Mitzrayim melech Yisrael al pi based in shehi muteres. If the Jewish state were to conquer parts of Egypt, fascinating, because this is what we've seen in our time, right? And if you think about Sharm el Sheikh, and you see, Yamit and all these places where, you know, like sort of there was a where Israel in a defensive war conquered the Sinai Peninsula, which are we heard the Rambam talk about this. He says then it would be all right, because really it's under Jewish sovereignty as opposed to Egyptian sovereignty. This says the Rambam, the reason is because it is a very corrupt culture, and so Hashem didn't want individuals being affiliated and associated with that culture. So therefore, it's not allowed. So the Rambam says, for trade and for military conquest, it seems to be all right. That's one dispensation which is talked about. And in this realm, the Radvaz, again, also a commentary on the Rambam, who lived in Egypt, makes the following observation at the end of source 10. He says the second last line, where there's a little ellipses, he says, V'im Tomar, that's the abbreviation, if you're going to ask, Tik Shile Rabbeinu, ask on the Rambam, Sharei Nishtakeh B'Mitzrayim. He seemed to not just visit, and he wasn't on a military conquest, and he wasn't just doing trade, he was living there. So how did the Rambam square that with his life? V'yeshlama da'onus hu al pi ha'amalchus shehi hoya rofe le'melech v'lesarim. He had no right to leave.
These people are playing off the Haggadah.
Yes, 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 very good. Yes, the language is very much right. Below Bale Lashtakersham, very good.
Yaakov.
Very good, very excellent point. Their advisor is playing off of that language clearly, and this is what he's doing. What's fascinating is that he says that the Rambam couldn't leave. In fact, it should be noted, historically speaking, I remember I was reading Rabbi Arya Kaplan's introduction to the 13 Principles of Faith. He pointed out that actually Richard the Lionheart offered to give a job to the Rambam as his physician, right? But the Rambam was not allowed to leave, and decided also not to leave the Sultan as well. He was very much in a sought after at the times of the Crusades. But Gamaninis Yashavti Sham Zman Merubeh, and he says, I myself, who's this? Rav Dovi Ben Zimra, by the way, just so you know, in our shul, Yehuda and Esther Lazar, right? So Esther is a Zamir. Zamir, actually, she descends from the Zimra family. So we have that bloodline in our shul, so of the Radvaz. And so Aninish Yashavti Sham Zman Muruba Lilmod Torah Lelamdo VeKovati Sham Yeshiva VeKihay Gav Namutar VeShuv Bas Yerushalayim. He says, I was there. I taught the population. I had a job that I needed to do, and I served the community I needed to serve to. And you know what says the Radvaz? And then I left. So after he lived to the age of 93 or 94, he lived an extensive life, a very successful spiritual life. And he says, I did my job. I was there for 40 years. And then I came to Jerusalem, and that's what I did. Now, it's interesting. The Rambam actually did come to Israel beforehand. The Rambam, you can read the Rambam's diaries of how he visited the Holy Land. And then he went down to Egypt. It seemed that it was not possible for the Rambam. There was no parnasa. There was no way to survive in Israel at the time. It was extremely difficult at the time the Rambam was living there. To do that, you can read the Ramban's accounting of arrival in Israel and how difficult. There wasn't even a minyan in Yerushalayim at the time the Ramban came. It was just after the times of the Rambam. It was very, very difficult. The Rambam found Parnassa in Egypt, and that was how he managed to settle there. So we see some explanations of it, whether it be for trade, whether it be for life as well. Remember, how did the Rambam arrive in Egypt in the first place? Why was he there in the first place?
He was running away
from the Almohads, right? The religion of peace had managed to had managed to occupy the Iberian Peninsula, and much like their successors, when it came to the Christians, their policy was very intolerant of other religions, and so the Rambam, as a late teenager, was on the run for his life. And that's when he arrived in Egypt. So the Tzitzeliers, when we talk about this as well, said, look, you have to appreciate the Rambam. The Rambam wasn't, you know, choosing to vacation in Egypt. He was, this was the only place that he was able to succeed. So, okay, so this is idea number one. Another perspective is that there are those who suggest that maybe the Egyptians of today are not the Egyptians of yesteryear. Right, it's not this, not the same glorious empire that we're talking about now. This tourism dependent country, which is on the brink of economic collapse in a year, that's not the Egypt of the pharaohs. So, as an example, the Rabbeinu Bachaya says in source 11, "Vahashem amar lachem lo sisun nashu v'aderech hazeh od zu mitzvah l'sha'a." This mitzvah is temporary. "Kadesh lo yilmudu Yisrael mimasem," so Israel should not learn from their actions. "Lefi shoyah mitzrim noidaim umufur samim b'chol toiva." The Egyptians are the most corrupt culture, most disgusting of peoples. "Kinyan shekos lukumas eretz mitzrayim v'goyim elochen tziva lohem elochem elayim klein." "Ve'ena mitzvah ledoros shi'asur akosuv hadira b'mitzrayim le'olam." It's not an eternal mitzvah to prevent people from being there. "V'arei onuroyim kamo kilos doros shame'az v'ad hayom," says the Rabbeinu Bachaya. There's many very respected communities that were there. "V'ilu oysa mitzvah ledoros lohayu Yisrael kadoshim hekilim bozeh ledorosham." How could a community be allowed to settle in the first place? So you could answer and say, well, they didn't really ask. But in the end of the day, he says, in defending the minhag of Israel for all these generations, he says, it must not be the same Egyptians. So, what do you mean they're not the same Egyptians? Can't they trace their lineage all the way back? And so, by the way, this is just important to appreciate. The Rabbeinu Bachaya is not a halachic sefer. So you've got to be careful about paskening from Rabbeinu Bachaya, who has an unbelievably beautiful commentary on the Chumash. But he was not a poisek in this regard, and this is not psak. But his observation is adopted in halacha. So, for instance, the smug, which is a halachic sefer, the sefer mitzvah gedolos, when enumerating the mitzvah, says, "Mitzvah memvav, the 46th mitzvah sheizarnu sheziranu mishkona beeretz mitzrayim l'olam kerei shaloi nilmod mikafirosam shaloi nech bedarkehem amagunay me'etzal ha'torav hu amru yisali lo yisusivu nishu mederech hazeh od." On that, commenting on that smak, the Rambam says, "Kishola sancheru melech Ashur bilbel kolamas v'irvom zebazeh v'higla oysom mimkomom v'ilu ha'ilu mitzrim sheberetz mitzrayim ato anoshim acherim heim." The folks today are Arabs. They're not Egyptians of the original lineage. "V'cheina adomim shebistei Edom v'hoyil v'nisarvu dalet umos ha'asurim b'chol umos ha'olam she'mutar hu'tar ha'kol she'kol ha'poresh mehem nisgayer cheskosa shepiresh min arayv." So therefore, ad kedei kach, says the Rambam, if a person who lives in Egypt today wants to convert to Judaism, we don't apply the Torah Isser on them, which is that an Egyptian is barred from access. Right, so why? Because they aren't the same folks.
Torah series.
So we don't have the same applications as the Rambam because of the foreign policy of the Assyrians, which was mixing the folks around. And since then, Egypt's not really been the same Egypt as it ever was. So that one possibility is that the prohibition was, like the Rambam said, was because of the corrupt culture, and their culture has been dismantled to a large part. It would be interesting to think about in terms of like what are the other cultures today that are equally as terrible and disgraceful, which the Jews have been part of.
But America wouldn't meet the smart standards as a model culture today.
It would be interesting to think about which cultures today have such difficult ideas that it might be more complicated not to live in. But nonetheless, that's another idea, is that perhaps Egypt's not the same Egypt. Another possibility is, and this is a very fascinating one, which is the Yerushalayim talks about this. He says that maybe the possibility is that when it says, "Loisosifun loshuv baderech hazeh od," the Torah is being precise when it says baderech. What does it mean, baderech hazeh? It means you're not allowed to go from where to where? From Israel to Egypt. But if you are living in Morocco, if you are living in Spain, you would be allowed to. The prohibition is not about living in Egypt. The prohibition is about leaving Israel to return to Egypt. That's what the Yerushalayim says. In fact, Ad Kedei Kach, we came across the Divrei Shaul Rav Shul Nathanson, who has the beginning of his commentary on, he has the Shas HaTshuvos. Divrei Shaul, very famous poisek, who says in his commentary on the Chumash, he says that that might be the reason why the Torah enumerates the 42 Masa'os. Why does the beginning of Parashas Maaseh go to such length to describe the 42 travels? Now, it turns out there's many Kabbalistic reasons. But what he says on a halachic level is because that is the wrong way to return, right? It's telling you this is the way you cannot go back to Egypt is along this trail, which is very fascinating because that limits the scope of this Issur tremendously, right? So if you decide that you're going to be going, you know, from Uganda to Egypt, you know, and then you're all right, according to this, because of the prohibition is really leaving Israel in this derech to regress, essentially, from Exodus. That's what would be this possibility over here. This is a very limiting perspective in terms of this mitzvah. And another two possibilities, the Ritva, in his commentary on the Gemara, Yoma says an interesting thing. He says in Source 16, it's similar but not the same. He says, "Nachon yoser she'ena Yisrahu ela bizman she'Yisrael," in Source 16, "sheruim al admasam." The primary Isser was leaving the land of Israel, but when we are no longer living in a sovereign, we don't have an Israel, we don't have a state, then really, it's all fluid. All of Chutzar, it's all the diaspora is the same. There's no one land which is worse than the others, and it should be fine as well. That's what the Ritva says. The Ritva lived in Spain, by the way. One last perspective I came across, which is actually the Sefer HaLikutim in Parshas Ki Tzeteh, written by Rav Chaim Vital. Why is Rav Chaim Vital so significant? Why do we know so much of his work?
He's the codifier of the Arizal.
He codified all the Arizal's teaching, right? The Arizal didn't write. It was his students, primarily Rav Chaim Vital, who wrote down the teachings of Rav Luria, the Arizal. And in the beginning of Parshas Ki Tzeteh, he talks about the first mitzvah. Now, this is an idea. This Kabbalistic idea is an extremely volatile and dangerous idea, which was used by false messiahs and by Hasidus alike. And it has an idea which people are very wary of. But listen to the idea. He talks about, and he says that the beginning of the parasha talks about this notion called Eshes Yefas Toar. They're at war. Israel's at war in a foreign country, and Mr. Soldier meets Mrs. Attractive, and the Torah says there's a certain process. We'll pave a process towards marriage. That's what the Torah says. And the Chazal said Lo Dibra Torah Elakol Keneged Yetzara. The Torah is talking about engaging the Yetzara. So the Rav Chaim Vital says you don't find that by the mitzvahs. It's like, you know, you're not really not supposed to eat hamburgers, but if you're stuck, right, then there's a way. You can leave the hamburger for 30 days, right? Like, that's not the way it works, right? So the Torah doesn't make, you know, dispensations for the weak or the weak of will. So what's going on over here? So he says it's linked to the same idea that we're talking about over here. And that is that he says, you notice that there's no prohibition to go back to Babylon, to go back to Persia, to go back to Greece, right? You could go to all these places, it's just fine. Why of all the exiles was it Egypt that is a prohibition? And he says, because there's a notion of what's called being birur hanitzotzos. What does that mean? That means when Adam and Eve sinned, there was a certain breaking of the kalim, of the vessels, of the receptacles of the divine light of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and those kalim were shattered and interdispersed in the entire world. So embedded in every part of the world is the pieces, the fragments, the shattered pieces of that that would capture, which had the divine light in it. And that means to say that really in every place in the world, there's the possibility of extracting some of that light, some of that goodness in the most dark or difficult of places, which is necessary. Now, by the way, just before going further, you understand why this is an interesting idea. Because this was what Rashab Tai Tzvi, Yemach Shemoy, said when he converted to Islam. Just so you should be aware. When he went, and when the Sultan gave him a very simple binary, option, it's either the gallows or Islam, he chose Islam, and then he explained to all his followers, who are Jews, who over 200 families converted to Islam after him, right, was that the reason was because he was going into the depths of Islam to pull out the holiness. I was like, that's a line you're not supposed to cross, right? So that doesn't work like that. And so when Hasidus started talking about these ideas, this is an idea which is heavily understood in Hasidus, the idea of Avera Lishma stems out of this, and it becomes a very dangerous idea. It is, and in fact, you know, just to appreciate this on the where it is used and it is appreciated on the in the correct way, is like Rav Tzorak HaKohen of Lublin talks about in Rissisei Laila, how the journey of Jewry through every country in the world is to absorb something of that culture, and to find something of the Torah value in that culture to extract it and bring it back to Judaism. That's the positive view of this. But you can understand how this can be misused and misappropriated by folks in a negative way if not understood by the right people. But be it as it may, so his observation is the following. He says, Egypt is devoid of the possibility of that. Why? He says, because when it talks about leaving of Egypt, it describes that Egypt was made, as the Gemara explains, the Pasuk was made like a mitzulah, like a net, which was, there were no fish left. All spirituality had been pulled out of Egypt when Israel left, which means there's nothing more there. There's no spirituality to pull out of it, unlike any other country in the world. It was that's how much of a nisroikana, of a emptying that happened. Then this is the Rav Chaim Vital's perspective. So it's not as so to speak as it's bad, but in the sense of like, but rather it's bad because there's no good. There's nothing else. There's no like. There's no mitigating factor. There's nothing that you can be doing there spiritually to derive. You're only surrounded in bad with no ultimate possibility of extracting good. So you say to yourselves, okay. So what do we do now, folks? Like, so these are some of the possibilities. We looked at a number of possibilities over here. We looked at the idea of perhaps the limitation of going for trade. We looked at the idea of maybe for teaching Torah, as the Radvaz talked about. We looked at the idea of the change of Egypt. Who are the Egyptians today? We talked about the pathway from Israel to Egypt, or maybe Jewish sovereignty, or even the idea of holiness to extract. So, lema'aseh. Well, what do we do under these circumstances is the question. How do we apply this? So, if we apply each of the different ones, the idea of a different nation, of being a different nation, that certainly applies today, because the Egyptians of today are not the Egyptians of old, right? So, that idea. Excuse me?
If Basel Chayr Bibus Ha'olim, according to Rambam source 13, you can reconcile it with Rav Chaim Vital.
Very good. Well said. So it could be that they might, that the people living there do have, but it seems like it's more a function of place more than it is of people. But that's interesting. But that depends on what the Isra is. Egyptians or Egypt. According to Smug, that's a different nation. Then there would be room to live there. And the Rambam seems to go with that principle. The idea of the Urim of leaving Israel. So that would be more of a problem for people who live in Israel to go to Egypt. But a person, say, flying from America would be less of an issue. The flying from Israel to Egypt might be more of a problem. The Ritva, the idea of Jews being in Golos, was actually taken to task by the Tzitzeliezer, Rav Waldenberg, in his 14th Chelek in Tshuva Pei Zion, talks about this Ritva, and he says that it isn't applicable today. Why? Because we have the state of Israel. So we're not in the same level of Golos, of exile, that the Ritva is talking about, that all of the diaspora is the same, because all the diaspora is not the same now. So he dismisses that possibility in that. What do we do today? So the Rav Ovadia Yosef talks about in Yechaveh Da'as, where he has this, Yechaveh Da'as is his redaction of his Pinat Halacha on the radio on Friday afternoons. In the third Chelek, Rav Ovadia Yosef, after going through many of these sources, says, "V'sikum mutar li'itoniim mi'Yisrael insoy li'Mitzrayim," so journalists. The question that was being asked can go to Egypt. You can talk about the peace process, because remember, this is the time when Menachem Begin and Sadat were arranging peace, and they were moving into the 70s, where there was this heralding of this new era, which was tremendous achievement, which has saved so many lives over the last decades. Is the peace with Egypt been a remarkable thing, which was achieved, paved the way by Yitzhak Rabin as the prime minister, and then later on followed up by Menachem Begin. He says for a specific job, it's permissible. So where do you put a vacation? So there is room to say. I mean, there is. It's not the same Egyptians. It might not be directly from Israel. Maybe if we say a little bit of the idea that there's a tough kid, but it's still a little bit of a gray area in terms of this. There's certainly room to say that it should be all right. But there's certainly also, and in fact, I believe that the way that Eretz Kemna came out and saying is that there's room to rely on going there. But I don't know if it should be number one on the list of places to be going, because there's certainly room to say that Jews should not be going there. It's not lishtakeya. It's certainly not to spend time there. No one wants to spend time. It's a defunct country. It's a country with an economy on the brink of collapse. But nonetheless, it should be. One should think about these things. That if there are possibilities of different countries to go to, this is not necessarily it should not be the number a possibility in terms of vacationing. There are much better places to go which don't involve getting into this particular sugya as well. Well, folks, thank you for taking the time. We're going to be doing, God willing, a topic in the next few weeks called The Journey of the Soul. I welcome everybody to join us. We're going to look at some of the perspectives of the neshama. Thank you so much, everybody. Thank you for joining us.